Hey, everybody, this is Tim Heidecker. You're listening to episode 8 of Please, Please Let It Be, the podcast where we go through every Beatles album, starting with Please, Please Me, all the way to their final album, Let It Be. With me is Eric Natornacola, as always, who is helping me digest and dissect all the amazing music and the stories and the rumors and the technology behind all these groundbreaking albums. Eric, good to see you. How are you holding up?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on again.
We have two guests. I'm going to quickly introduce the first guest, get through that as quick as possible. It is a friend of ours and one of the a great titan in comedy, a legend if you're a fan of television. Mr. John Levenstein is with us.
Thank you guys for having me.
And John, we love to gab. We love to talk music. We love to talk about all sorts of things, so we were happy to invite you. I don't really know if you're like a Beatles fan the way we are.
Not as much as you guys, but I am a big fan. Like, I'm not as knowledgeable as you guys, but we did have some Twitter conversations early on about this, and my contribution to the conversation is mainly introducing my friend who was there.
Yes, we reached out to you, John, said, do you want to do the show? Just because we like to talk to you. And you said, well, you know what I could do? What I could bring to the table is I could bring you a very special guest that you're not going to believe. You didn't say that, but essentially it's the way we felt. You are here to introduce our very special guest. And do you want to introduce him or should I? Because my show.
My old friend, my old boss, music pioneer, video pioneer, a sweetheart from Central California, Michael Nesmith.
Michael Nesmith, you are now part of podcast history as you are my guest on Please, Please Let It Be. What an honor to have from the Monkees and many other things, Mr. Michael Nesmith. Thank you for being here, sir.
It's like Whopper Room. I'm thinking this is a good time.
Yeah.
Is this a man cave?
This is where I am. Yeah. I'm in my garage that I've converted into a studio, to a home studio. I do music here. I do, whatever I need. You know, I get away from I have two kids, 3 and 6. So I'm hiding down here most days, especially during the pandemic.
I was a mechanic hobbyist. Hot rod built or racer. And I would, all the way through, up and through the Monkees, I was constantly racing one thing or another. And then one time when Christian, my oldest boy, was 20 something, he said, you know, I never went racing with you. And I felt some horrible loss.
Oh, yeah.
I really did. I thought, God, Christian, that's come and gone. We can't ever do that. I suppose maybe that's way too weepy for this time.
Are you saying that I'm wasting my time down here talking to you and I should be upstairs playing with my children?
I'm not at all. I could not be better use of your time.
Yeah.
And Michael, just to reassure you, you know I never wanted to go racing with you, right?
No, I don't know that.
Okay, I never wanted to.
Okay.
Good.
Well, We're here talking about the 8th album by the Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Probably, I mean, really, just so you know, Michael, we are massive fans. But this isn't a show just to like, we love everything about the Beatles. You know, we've got some issues here and there. So just to let you know, we're going to be somewhat,
Do you mean failings that you hear in the?
I mean, just kind of personal feelings about them, you know. You know, nothing. What like? Not that we're better than them, but you know, not to jump ahead. But when I'm 64, do I need to hear When I'm 64 again?
No.
Sorry.
This is a Constellation cast, I think. I'm sorry. I was talking over myself. Where were we?
Well, I just wanted to warn you that Eric and I and you are welcome to, you know, lodge your complaints with the record if you so desire to.
Oh,
we're talking about what we like and what we don't like.
Yeah.
And it all comes from a place of peace and love.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm going to be completely worthless because I grade all Beatles records at 100+.
Really?
Yeah.
You should work for the AV Club.
Yeah. Well, maybe I do and don't know it, but... it was such a critical part of my life, all the way from the Ed Sullivan appearance to the first weekend with John and Cynthia. And it was, it's indelible. I think about it not frequently, but I think about it. And, you know, it was a world changer, a mind changer, a life changer and everything. You know, the simplicity of two guys sitting in one's living room while the other guy played the first one some music. So, this is what I've been doing all day in the studio. We call it Sergeant Pepper's and blah, blah, blah. And does the bass sound too loud to you? And I think, holy fuck, what? Just rearranged my musical reality and then asked me how the bass sounded. So I was awestruck, flummoxed, dumbstruck. I said nothing. And I was that way that whole time I was there.
So
I remember nothing.
Yeah. I was going to try to ask this, and I was trying to figure out the best way to ask it. But like, so you guys come onto the scene in late 66. And by early next year, you're hanging with the guys, with the Beatles in London. That seems like that must have just been such an out-of-body experience for you to travel so quickly from, not really being known to suddenly you're hanging with John Lennon. You're young and I guess you're just kind of rolling with it, but were you able to appreciate that in the moment?
I don't think I have the appreciation then that I have for it now. And as I look back on it now, those troughs, if I can call them that, of gratitude are deep.
Yeah.
Long, and it's something that has shaped me. And I don't know what happens after we die, but I don't know that anything will happen to those memories. I mean, I can't imagine what it must have. Well, I guess I can in a way. Must have been like to play at, a stadium. But
but how cool is it that they were cool with you?
How did that friendship
that could have gone the other way, right? Those guys could have been assholes to you.
Well, we were in different media.
Yeah.
We were television stars, which they just acknowledged.
Right.
They were all television fans.
Right.
And, a couple of their directly related star fan friends had come over to spend the weekend with them. And so they were as wiggly and giggly as we were.
You guys were all like around the same age, right? Like
we were the same age. I think McCartney and I are the same age and the same height.
Still the same age. No one's aged faster than the other. It's unbelievable.
When I'm never before.
Well, he's a little, I guess he's always going to be a little older than you being in the UK. So let's jump into this record. So you were, like you said, you were a fan of these guys when they broke like everybody else. You weren't some kind of cool hipster who was like, F these guys, F these, this boy band. You were like, these guys rock right away.
Well, I was a San Antonio College folk music-y student in drama and orchestra or something like that. One of those nerds.
Yeah.
That's who I was. And I couldn't speak or write or read music, and I didn't like band music, and I couldn't march worth a shit. And it was, one dreadful experience after another until I found the folk music guys,
right?
The people in folk music clubs, and they were, it wasn't, Blind Willie, Jack, Cripple. It was the guys who
Kingston Trio, that kind of thing.
Yeah, right. It was much more whitewashed.
Right.
Sounded very, very white too. It wasn't awful, but how people sat through an evening of it, I'll never know.
With those cable knit sweaters and everything?
Stop it. Yeah.
But so then I Want to Hold Your Hand comes. That's got to be like the first thing you hear from them. And that doesn't sound like, I'm just trying to imagine if you're a folkie, like, do you hear that? And if I was, you know, in high school or something in college, and like, let's say the Backstreet Boys comes out, I'm like, my first reaction is like, you know, F that a little bit. But did you, I mean, maybe you don't, maybe it took a little bit of warming up to, but was
I lost your train of thought.
Well, back up. Were they, did your first interaction with the Beatles feel like it was like a frivolous pop group for the girls, or was it something that you immediately responded to?
Oh no. I'm hesitating a little bit because I don't want to speak for anyone but myself, but what I know of myself and the conversations that I had with Mickey and Peter and David was that we revered those guys, all of us, uniformly. Yeah. I mean, these were the finest purveyors of that kind of music, the greatest pop writers of our time. They were painting images in flames.
Yeah.
It was, I don't know. I think because it hit television, when it finally got to the viewer, it was palpable. It hit you. It raised the skin on your arms.
Yeah.
Did you move back? The only other band or performer that ever did that for me came later, not much, was Hendrix. But the Beatles were the first time I felt it. And I felt it in the Shea Stadium and a couple of times I saw them. And I've been hearing a phrase around a call that is a felt presence as a description of something that may be spiritual. You can't see it, but you just know it's there.
Right.
And that felt presence is amplified by impossible to conceive of astronomical magnitudes and takes over a room when you get four power, you know, or a factor of four. That the four of those guys, when they stepped out just in the view of the public, you felt that, you know, Space Force 3 or 4 or whatever.
Right.
Just like, what the hell just happened? But when they played and the music came out, you listen to their harmonies and the perfection with which they played with each other.
Yeah.
And resultantly with us, the audience, it was divine.
Yeah.
Absolutely heavenly. It was and I just kept looking at Phyllis, my wife at the time, and people who were around, and I said, this is it. This is what it's supposed to be. And sitting there at that time, I could not in my wildest dreams imagine doing what the four of us are doing right now.
That's true. Well, we're not breaking too much ground, but let's get into the album. Okay, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. There's so much I want to ask you about, but you were over there before it came out. Were you there for one of the sessions? I can't remember what the story is here with this particular record.
All of the above, yeah.
So were you at like the famous Day in the Life session with all the, where it was the party? You were there.
Yeah.
Were you just in London doing shows, or what were you doing over there?
You know, I can't remember. I think that the shows sounds like as good a alibi as any.
And I guess, was it broadcast and over there? Like, was it broadcast all over? It was broadcast on the BBC or something? Like, where did the Monkees air? This is what the audience wants to know.
Well, it was, it had full European clearances. So it was Sweden and Europe and
right.
I mean, UK and the KK and RK and the PK.
Right.
And it was, I think, South America, half a dozen of the countries in Europe. And
that's how you do it. You go worldwide with this stuff, because then you can go. You guys could go anywhere.
Yeah, so it would appear.
Well, not anymore, but about four months ago, you could go anywhere. You guys. So I should say, you and Mickey were in the middle of playing shows, or what was going on when things started shutting down? You had some shows.
You mean here recently?
Yeah.
As a result of this pandemic?
Yeah. You have to push things?
Well, there was too much of an uproar when we started making noises about canceling. So we said, well, we'll just postpone it. And that was almost instantly subscribed. So, yeah. Right. So it was like, that's what people want to do. They want to be able to kind of move the schedule around to fit them.
Right.
And so we'll go back out. I mean, there's no question that we'll go ahead and finish up the tour. It's just not going to be in the same dates. Probably we'll be in the same places. Just won't be in the same dates, times and stuff.
And you guys will be in hazmat suits when you play as well.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, every time that I play together, we're, no contact possible.
Yeah. All right. So, Sergeant,
I want to help Michael set the stage because
go ahead.
Not sure this has been made clear.
You're a storyteller, John. You take
during the recording of Sergeant Pepper, Michael was staying with John Lennon, and John Lennon would come home at the end of the day and play recordings for Michael and ask him to pass judgment on them, which Michael would refuse to do because Michael loved everything. And then Michael actually went to the session. That was the day in the life day, right, Michael?
All of the above is true.
Okay, I'm muting myself again, you guys.
Okay. Thank you, John, for clearing that up. What would you do? Why would you remember this? What do you do during the day while they're recording? You're just sitting around John Lennon's mansion?
Well.
Did you see Big Ben and Carlin?
No. Give me a second. I'll form it up. It's impossible for me to describe some of the great English characteristics in their full orbed integrity, but they are the mannerisms, and polite manner in company means way more than it does in the United States.
Right.
And that people cultivate it so that they give off the aura of fine breeding and, you know, fine education and all of the other things, even if they don't have the money, which is the foundation of it all, to go with it. So there's this kind of odd, very filmic overlay, which looks like, you know, a different film process in every party that you go to in English society. And it's something that rings ancient and, you know, of the Stones. I mean, it's not the Rolling Stones.
Right.
But
not
the Welling.
Not their class.
No. And it's a strange kind of thing. So I've now lost the train of thought.
Well, you sound like you were treated very respectfully while you were over there and courteously.
It was, and for me and John, he never said anything. I never said anything. But for me, it was love at first sight. You know, I thought, boy, this can be a great friend.
Right.
I understand, you know, if he found somebody like McCartney, how it would create a bond like that.
Well, they were also such fans of America. They were such fans of American music. I mean, they just must have been thrilled to hang out with a guy from Texas. I mean,
well, I think so, but I felt in their hands, I felt a little bit like, you know, a chemical reagent that is in the hands of a master chemist. I
mean, right.
They can kind of do whatever they want to, and it's fine with me. I'll do what I do. And I love, you know, I love playing with them and playing, you know, but it was all just kind of living room stuff and banky, twanky, danky, all that stuff. And it was, there was no real musicianship in any of it.
Right.
But what was there was a kind of the soul of a musician, the soul of music, the soul of things. And, That's what I kept taking out of it, taking from it and realizing. And when I think back on those times, those are the memories that I have and that are so precious to me and stay with me. They're so strong.
That's just beautiful.
Right in my face like that.
So when you're there and you're around the, you know, they come off of Revolver. They had, I guess they had Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane had come out as singles. Is there the feeling? Is there the palpable feeling?
Those are the first two songs in the session.
Those are the first two songs, but they had come out while they're still recording the album, I believe.
But they were originally intended to go on the record.
Right.
So they were originally supposed to be part of the Sgt. Pepper's on the label.
They rushed it out.
They released them as double A-sides, yeah.
What tracks are you talking about?
Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane.
Oh, well, I'm clearly not on the inside enough to know that.
But I guess my question was, when you're over there and they're recording that, is there a sense that the band is taking another big leap with the stuff they're doing? Or is it feeling like expected of them to be working at this level?
Hi, this is Vic Berger here. And you know I don't like stress. That's why I'm personally inviting you to eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious meals. Every Factor meal is fresh and never frozen, it's chef-created, dietitian-approved, and it's ready to eat in just 2 minutes. I tried the Chef's Choice meal plan, and it was a chef's kiss of meals that hit all the spots and filled our bellies at the Berger household. I know you're asking yourself, what were Vic Berger's favorites? Creamy Dijon pork tenderloin and garlic herb saman. These are classic dishes that are ready to go with no cleanup and not a problem at all. So get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals. And get back to doing what you love this spring. Now, these are premium meals with premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. Sign up now! Head to factormeals.com/officehours50 and use code officehours50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code officehours50. OFFICEHOURS50 at factormeals.com/officehours50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I think it was probably the latter. These guys were unbelievable talents. Their capacities and talents in all directions of thought was just celestial. They were of a time.
And you knew that then. You felt that then. It wasn't something that you've... Like, that's just so fascinating to me because so much has been kind of lumped onto them through people on about it. But in the moment, you feel that.
No, you do feel it. You feel it when you're with the big guns.
Yeah.
There are very few people that have it. You would think they would have it, but they don't. There's a posing quality and an inauthentic quality.
Right.
But when you're with the guys, what they're playing in their own mind is their own version of their own Star Spangled Banner. They have something happening in their head that the ordinary Sly Fox does not.
Let's get into the record. We're just going to play through the record, and Eric and I will talk. If you want to talk, chime in. We start with Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, obviously, title track. John Levenstein, what does this song do to you emotionally?
I wanted to say, the song that does something for me emotionally is Penny Lane, and it's a shame it's not on the album.
Well, that's fine. We can talk about the singles. Sgt.
Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band doesn't do that much for me. But I remember hearing Penny Lane before the album came out, and it's such so of a piece with those recording sessions, you know?
Yeah, sure. I mean, they were supposed to be on the record. And I think When I'm 64, and I forget if it's Fixing a Hole or Good Morning, Good Morning, they were written and recorded to replace those two songs on the record.
And When I'm 64, again, before I mute myself, Michael, here's my problem with giving every Beatles song a 100 is you leave yourself no room to operate.
Yeah.
Like, you give When I'm 64 and Michelle a 100, and then what do you do for the other songs? 120?
No. You shift spectra and you go to color.
Naturally. Come on, John.
When I'm 64 is black and white, then, I presume.
That's a good
Well, we've been charting. Let's just do this in order. Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. I think it's a rocker. It rocks, you know. It's got a little bit. It's heavy. You can hear it. You could hear, like, I know you mentioned Jimi Hendrix. Hendrix comes out, like, and plays this. He plays, like, a really heavy version of Sergeant Pepper's, the theme song. But it is kind of like a nothing.
It's kind of a novelty song.
It's a novelty song.
It's sort of the frame. It's a frame of this concept record, and it's kind of filled with, like, those sort of, like, rock and roll stage platitudes of, like, hello everybody, here we are, now someone's gonna sing a song, like, you know, the kind of, like, meaningless banter at the beginning of a rock show.
Yeah, that doesn't really exist,
but doesn't do a lot for me.
I don't guess I know what you mean. Could you explain it better?
You never had something like that, did you, that you could rely on to start a show?
I just couldn't resist.
That's funny. That did not occur to me at all until you just started going down that road.
What was the iconography? Like the marching band, the military? Like, was it made up by them? Was it something that existed? Why was that what was interesting to them?
It was, I don't know. There was the poster in John's, you know, the houses of the 20s, the big mansions of the 20s, that they had this open air space porch that was surrounded by screen.
Like an indoor garden kind of thing?
Yeah. The what?
Like an indoor garden kind of thing? Yeah. Like a mud room?
Yeah. Rattan everywhere, wicker, and all sort of white and so forth. Well, he had one, and in that was an upright piano that was in the middle of disassembly.
Huh.
And there were bottles of opened and unopened fingernail polish and bottles of and tubes of acrylic and stuff around and a jar full of paintbrushes and so forth. And he had the frontispiece off of the piano and he was painting each key a different color inside the piano. Very mild. And there was no spectrum to it. There wasn't anything like, oh, that's
look, right. No rhyme or reason to it.
The rhyme or reason was Lucy in the Sky.
Right.
So
this is the beginning of this very psychedelic sort of aesthetic, visual aesthetic that they started
It was psychedelic art. And there was nothing else to explain it. And I'm telling you guys because I'm praying that you say, yeah, that's it, man. That was it. Because it really was. I was standing there in the middle of this psychedelic fire that was coming up around my feet and creating this piano in front of me, which John Lennon was playing Sergeant Pepper's on. And, you know, oh, really? Could you pass the spam?
But John, you're talking about like that military Edwardian turn of the century brass band kind of thing.
But it was very colorful. So was that just all part of the psychedelia, Michael? The outfits?
No, well, once you look at the album cover, you begin to understand the level of work. And the little bit of time that I was there, that work was going on around me. You know, they were rushing costumes here and there and stuff. But I never got a decent look at any ethos or any kind of, you know, dynamic that was going on
right
in the middle of it. I don't know that it was ever anything other than a circus poster.
Yeah.
And it was just one that hung in John's garden wall.
So then we'll move on to, I think Eric and I were talking earlier, this is our favorite Ringo song. I mean, he didn't write it, but With a Little Help from My Friends is a great song, great track. Great sounding track.
Yeah, well, it's anthemic as well.
Yeah.
Sort of those rock anthems.
Oh, man. Everybody can sing along to this. Great bass playing on this. Eric, talk to us about the bass in this song, could you?
So for this song, I think it's maybe my favorite bass tone.
Sorry,
that
I'm
I've
just
ever
doing
heard McCartney do. And I love Paul McCartney's tone, and I think this is the peak of his bass tone. It's round. It's like it punches. It's rubbery. It's so good. And it's just one of my favorite bass tones from him. And also a great bass line.
Is he playing a Rickenbacker? Is that what he's doing?
This is his Rickenbacker 4001, yeah.
And he's recording, he's overdubbing this after the rhythm track?
Yeah, that was a technique that he started doing on Revolver, I think. And whoops. Sorry about that. I've got a little chord issue. So, yeah, so on this record in particular, he would record his bass lines last to just make sure that they were, he could put as much attention into them as possible. So he would play a lot of piano and guitar on the backing track and then go in and overdub. They'd save a channel on the four track for his bass at the very end.
How unheard
and
of
it really shows that I think this album has his best bass playing, in my opinion. It's my favorite bass lines of his are on this album.
Mike, how aware were you that like these guys are taking more time on these records than people are used to on these kind of rock records? Like nobody, like a lot of, most people didn't have that kind of luxury, right? To like spend that much time in the studio.
You know, we had John and I had a couple of conversations of no particular depth and nothing really to report about what Sergeant Pepper's was. It was an excursion, an exploration of new territory.
Right.
It was a creative expansion.
It was a way for them to leave the personas of themselves, of the Beatles, with, right? And sort of like...
It was that, but I don't think that move would have been made that consciously. And I think it happened, but it didn't happen by design. It happened by... the force of art.
Right. And they almost had to. Something had to change for them to keep wanting to do it, I guess. Like you have to kind of mix things up or you get pretty stale and pretty bored and yep. Not very creative, right?
Yes, you're right. And it the things did not change and it did stall. It stopped.
Right.
I think Tim, when I texted you guys about a little help from my friends, I think my issue with that song was I read an article about it, about how everyone pulled together to root Ringo on that last high note before going back and listening to the song for the first time in years. And after reading the article, that last high note is not that impressive.
All right, let me play it.
It is for Ringo though.
Oh, hold on. Let me get to that part. I think what's hard about that is that the chords going under that note are changing in a way that make it hard to hold that note.
Go, Ringo. You can do it, Ringo.
John, can you do that note for us? John.
No way.
Yeah, John, you do
that. Oh, okay. Oh, all of a sudden.
Ronnie, I think he's going to do it. It looks like he's going to do it.
Come on.
He's going to make it the whole way. B1 the horse.
Friends. Listen to that bass line though. I mean that's really nice. Tasty stuff.
Yeah. All right, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. This song for me is what really turned me onto the Beatles as a kid in a way, because my dad had the greatest hits collection on cassette. And I wasn't really into the Beatles. I didn't know who they were, but he would play it. And when this song came on, me and my sister thought it was a joke. We would close our nose and be like, picture yourself. You know, like we're like, what the hell is this? But something about it captivated me and made me want to keep listening. And, you know, in general, this record is the one where I remember very distinctly, you know, this I guess will date me for Eric, for you making me feel old, and for John and Mike making me feel young, but when the CD for this came out, I was like, when CDs came out, I was like, I got to go get Sgt. Pepper's to play on the CD player, because that's the ultimate test of what a record should sound like as a, you know, a 12-year-old boy. That was my idea. But Lucy and the Skywinds,
not for me.
What?
That doesn't date you at all for me. I mean, I had the same experience CDs came out.
Sorry.
It's very relatable. I also love this one as a kid too. I think this had a really big impact on me because I don't think it just didn't sound like any of the other songs that I was listening to. You know, it's so different from a production standpoint.
This is John Lennon as the fan of Lewis Carroll, the surrealism, the imagery. Obviously, Mike, you're sitting in his sunroom seeing some of the psychedelic influences weave away into his art and into his life. The story behind the title apparently comes from Julian, his son, who drew a picture, went in and showed him. Let's take a vote. Who thinks they were trying to be clever and put LSD on the record? Is there any, you think that, John?
Yes.
He insists that it was a coincidence.
Mike?
No, I know from John's mouth to my ears that it was not a reference to LSD. It was a reference to a crayon picture that was sitting on John's lap that his daughter had drawn, I think with the help of an adult or two.
Yeah, that's what
I believe John and Mike and Michael.
Wait, you're not hearing my story. I'm talking about John's daughter.
So John's son, Julian, you mean?
No.
Wait, start again.
Wait, what?
Is there a daughter we don't know about?
Didn't I get your attention?
Yeah, there's a daughter out there? An illegitimate Lennon daughter that we don't know about?
No, it's way too inside.
Okay.
I'll leave it alone.
But the Beatles, you, John Levinstein, you think that they're being clever and winky with the LSD, Lucy?
Well, I can't separate from this other question because I was a kid when it came out. And like other kids, I was 8 when it came out. We played the record forward and backwards and we looked for Paul is Dead clues. So like in that album, in Magical Mystery Tour, it seemed like the Beatles were burying all kinds of clues in their recordings, right? Yeah. And so we were geared to look for clues and it seemed like they wanted us to look for clues. So when we found things that weren't there, I think that they have to take some of the responsibility for that because they were playing games and I was a child playing along.
Right. Okay.
Not guilty.
Now this is, Eric, this is your favorite song on the record, Getting Better.
Yeah. Well, it's a tie with Day in the Life.
Whoo! Look at those guitars. How cool is this song? What does this even sound like to you guys that's not the Beatles? It's so singular to them.
The production on this record is so amazing.
That was their reach for the Beach Boys.
That was their Beach Boys nod, right? A little bit?
Yeah, reach for the Beach Boys. I mean, the way John talked about it, there was a real mutual admiration society. And they had been trying for a while to get a Beach Boys thing. They thought Paperback Writer was going to do it for them.
Right.
And then this was, well, just listen to the background vocals.
Yeah.
It's like the Beach Boys doing it. But this was all the Beach Boys, the whole Beach Boys period that they were in.
What was your relationship with the Beach Boys? Did you guys have a relationship with them at all?
No, I was, I had worked with Bruce Johnston when I first got out to LA, made friends with him and sort of hung in his circles. And when he spun off to do the Beach Boys, I tagged along a couple of dates and then that was the end of it. That was never my scene.
Yeah. I would have stayed away from those guys. They seemed like trouble. You know, on the one end, Brian Wilson, you know, he's got issues. And then Mike Love he seems like a, you know, problem.
Not a fun hang.
And then next thing you know, you're hanging out with Charles Manson. You don't want to be hanging out with Charles Manson.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of places not to go there.
Yeah. Eric, anything else you want to say about Getting Better, because it is your favorite song on the record, tied with The Day in the Life?
I just wanted to break down a couple of the parts. It's so fun. Go ahead, please. You have this cool bass line. It's like... And then it's got this like walking... It's very cool. Very cool. Some great drumming from Ringo on it.
Now, we also... you have the songwriting dynamic of John and Paul on full display here, according to them, which is you have Paul writing pretty much the 90% of this song, but according to Paul, John's contribution is it can't get no worse, right? It can't get much worse, as the reply to it's getting better, which is...
It's a little bit of sour to the sweet.
Yeah,
which it is adds a little sort of sardonic. Like the best of those two as co-writers, right?
Absolutely. And again, if there is an influence of John writing lyrics here, you have sort of this pretty dark verse about, I used to be cruel to my woman. I hit her, kept her apart from the ones that she loved. Like,
I always thought it was interesting that during that part, the mix kind of shifts more towards John's vocal and away from Paul's, as if Paul's subconsciously saying like, all right, this is John's.
That's funny.
This is John speaking here. This is not me.
You know, the one thing.
Here's something I wondered, Michael, because it seems like the Beatles bantered a lot. Were they mean? Were they ever mean when they would banter? Or was it lighthearted?
I never saw them be mean to a soul.
Interesting.
Especially each other. There was great, I don't know what the word is, but it was decorum of a kind, of a type, you know, and a recognition. The other musicians, Clapton and you know, those guys,
right,
that traveled as a like a posse circles around the main writer, they all were there in adoration of the Beatles.
Right.
And they would part when the Beatles would go through a door. The Beatles would not separate. They would walk in fours like that.
And they were nice to each other, in your experience.
They were extremely cordial and convivial and wicked smart and funny.
Well, there's a great video, John. I just retweeted it earlier today, but there's this video. It's them doing a one of those, you know, TV performances where they're kind of lip syncing along with it to a backing track, and they're doing "We Can Work It Out." And I don't know if they might have had a little pot or whatever, but John is making Paul laugh, and it is the cutest, most endearing video, because they can't control themselves. They're cracking each other up, and you know, it's like 65 or something, you know, and they just seem to just be the biggest fans of themselves, of each other.
I just watched them doing Help together.
Yeah.
And what I was struck by was that when John was singing, Paul was very generous in his facial reactions to John singing when they're singing together. Very generous.
Yeah, they were I mean, you see it too when John and Paul are doing in their live shows, you see John and Paul singing together. You see George and he's kind of singing along in a way that you do when you're enjoying the song and you're like supporting your friends and you're there, you know, backing them up. So that's cool to hear. I mean, listen, Mike, you're our primary source that we could never have imagined getting this kind of access. So we appreciate it.
If you get a chance to read Infinite Tuesday, do, because I lay all this out in there. One of the things we haven't talked about, and I don't think I can.
Oh, good.
Do it justice, was the cultural milieu. It was a completely different, utterly unique spot in all the world.
Yeah.
In the 60s. And it's I can't describe it. I've heard people who talked about Paris in the 20s in first person. And I thought, gosh, I would have loved to have been there. You know, the Left Bank and the whole thing that's going on with jazz and just the romance of it. And I realized it could never happen for me. And when it did, when there was a sense of this music will live forever, and so will these times. This is a generation shift and it's a place into something else. It's unforgettable. You'll never lose it. And so I just sit back, relax, enjoy the ride.
Yeah.
Keep your hands inside the car at all times. And that's what I did. And it was just like that. I was just like a little dog with my tongue hung out the window. But I was noticing, maybe like the little dog, that these guys were not manic in any sense. They were droll and they were clever and they were just whatever pace the room was in, they were on that pace. They were masters. I can't describe it any better than that. I know I sound like this adoring.
No, it's so great. I mean,
fan, but that's the way I felt. I still do.
Yeah. I mean, it feels very earned. It feels like they earned your admiration. It didn't, it's not, yeah. You know.
Before we move on,
yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I just want to say the guitars in this are so cool, and that there's this like repeated kind of like high G that acts as a pedal. So like in the verses, it's like with the G is still in the root note of the C and the G, but then when you go to the to the chorus, the progression is really cool because it's like
oh yeah. It stays there. The G's.
So yeah, so it's like, even though the G has left the chords. It's in the other guitar. It's just a very cool, like, upward moving progression with that pedal.
It almost sounds like a busy signal that's going on.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway.
Fixing a hole. Now, this is obviously about heroin and doing heroin with needles, right? I mean, obviously. No, I'm just kidding. Never made any sense to me.
Let's hear a little bit of it.
I'm fixing a hole where the rain gets in and stops my mind from wandering where it will go.
This really feels like the Beatle-esque sound is very present here. The harpsichord, like if you're going to do a parody of a Beatles mid-60s swing, like London swinging 60s kind of sound, you get the harpsichord sound up, right?
I think McCartney was fond of it, right?
The harpsichord?
I don't know what you mean by the harpsichord. I don't hear
the harpsichord. Yeah, because he's got the clavichord on.
That's not a harpsichord that's playing?
Might not be coming through very well on the Zoom.
Oh.
It might be a little mushy on the Zoom.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I think it's a harpsichord, right? If you guys can hear.
It could be like a tack piano or something.
That's Paul McCartney singing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What strikes me about that song is it seems like Paul McCartney singing like John Lennon.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, well, he does this. He does this like Lennon. He can do this Lennon impression that he does sometimes. Like you hear it on "Love Me Do" when he says "Love Me Do." He's like doing this kind of like Lennon impression to sound to blend better with him, and he does it really well. It's like he does it when he harmonizes too.
I don't. You know, it's not one of my favorite Beatles songs, "Fixing a Hole," but it serves. It creates a nice texture and atmosphere for the record.
If someone told you it was his favorite Beatles song, what would you think of that person? It'd be weird.
I know someone who they said their mom's favorite Beatles song is "The Fool on the Hill."
Well, that's a hit. That was a hit. But
it's still an odd choice.
What if John, do you think there's anybody out there who says, "I hate the Beatles, but I love that song, Fixing a Hole"?
Maybe.
I hate all their songs except that one. I wanted to do a sketch, John, where it's Sergeant Pepper's. So they find out that there is a Sergeant Pepper out there, that from like the 1800s or something, and he was this awful, you know, he like slaughtered a Zulu tribe or something. Like he's a British general that they found was just this absolutely reprehensible imperial general, and so the Beatles have to decide, you know, because now Sergeant Pepper has gotten canceled in culture, so they re-release Sergeant Pepper's under a new name. They have to come up with Admiral Spice something because the name Sergeant Pepper has become so toxic.
Did you take it far enough to write songs?
No. All I've done is talk about it with my friends. All right. Fixing a Hole leads into, I think, one of my favorite Paul McCartney songs ever, She's Leaving Home.
It's a beauty.
Do you have an issue with this, John, Mike?
I love it.
It's beautiful. It's a great story. This feels like, you know, we're on a journey with Paul McCartney now. He's kind of taking over the band. I don't know if, Mike, you could sense this at all at the time. Was there a sense that Paul was contributing more to this group at this point? There was a kind of power struggle happening within the group?
Well, I never got the slightest bit of friction, sensed the slightest bit of friction from between any of the boys.
Right.
The exchange of dialogue, power, place, and everything and position between the four of them was just seamless. It was like watching a beautiful dance.
Wow.
They were as good in those social graces as they were in the musical ones. So they never discussed in front of me anything the slightest bit controversial.
Right.
This would have been, off.
Right.
And second of all, the great quest was upon all of us, including the Beatles, which was we have to have the biggest, best-selling album of all time.
Right.
The best music in the world. This is our time. We have to do it.
Yeah, the pressure was on, right?
Pressure was kind of on, I think. I mean, I think it was less pressure than it was
aspiration. Well, I heard Paul Simon talk about that when they were Bridge Over Troubled Waters or The Boxer. There was this sense of like, what did the Beatles just do? We got to do something that's bigger, and we have to. We're all kind of like playing off each other to make a huge splash.
Yeah,
creatively, but commercially too.
Yeah. No, that's right. That was everywhere present. It was like, you know, being at the Olympics. You're just walking down the street. You never knew who was running for their 10th gold medal or just, you know, running for their first bronze.
Right.
But they were all these magnificent animals. It's a little bit of an embarrassment, but not that much. When I was at the Day in the Life session, Mick and, God damn it. Mick and, Marianne came, and this is Jagger and Faithful, if you don't know.
Yeah.
And I looked up, and she came in the door. I think she was just in front of Mick, and he peeled off, and she was just left alone, and she was walking towards me, and I was standing alone. And I thought, oh, my God, who the fuck is this? This is the most gorgeous creature I've ever seen in my life. This is what every rock and roll song was about.
Right.
And then somebody from who knows where, some ghost of rock and roll sessions past, said, "That's Marianne Faithful." And I thought, well, fuck, of course. Kind of an idiot I am, embarrassed.
That's Marianne Faithful, you know.
Yes. Yeah, you're like, hey, you know who's pretty?
Yeah. You must have towered over these guys. You must have, because all these British, like especially the Rolling Stones, they're like tiny guys.
They're all 5'4".
Yeah.
No, I kid.
Michael.
Well, I mean, I've been told that on the television ensemble of us in a television camera, it makes me look imperiously tall, and I wasn't. Peter and I were nearly the same height. He was a couple of inches shorter. I went downstairs pretty drastically to David. But it was all carefully planned.
Yeah.
I was happy to go along with it.
Tim, here's the thing about Paul taking over the band. From my experience at the time and from most fans' experience at the time, no one had any idea which Lennon and McCartney songs were written by Lennon and which were written by McCartney. So it probably made it easier for John that they were all labeled Lennon-McCartney songs.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, what we were noticing...
You could tell the difference in who sang? Or some of it's hard to tell.
Who sang, but as far as the composition went, it was not common knowledge to the public that they were really divided up towards the end as far as who wrote what.
Well, right. You know, we've been going through these albums and sort of really analyzing all the songs. And what struck us as we kind of worked through that sort of mid-period of like Beatles for Sale, Help, Rubber Soul, was John was writing, was first of all, the records were mostly John songs, at least where
especially
he was
Hard
singing.
Day's Night and Hard Day's Night in particular.
And A Hard Day's Night included in this, where there are a lot of John singing, a lot of very personal, confessional songs that, you know, some of them might have just been kind of girl meets boy songs, but you could tell there was like some issues with, you know, like jealousy or, you know, mostly jealousy, but sort of these kind of, you know, you could get a little glimpse into his psychology, and they got more and more personal. Help, of course, is very, very personal. Like, I'm a loser. All these songs are like, in my life. And then on this record, it just seems to go away. Like, this is obviously, he's maybe said all he's wanted to say about that. He's writing much more sort of like reporting or writing about sort of from a more of surreal place. And he's just not writing as much of the music coming out, which, you know, maybe it was exhaustion or maybe it was the psychedelics he was doing that kind of changed his perspective or his priorities. But you see, there's like almost no Paul on, what was it that we were saying? There was no Paul on Hard Day's Night. I mean,
I mean, Help is an especially great album for John, too. I wonder also, like, I could imagine at that point, it's like if he and Paul were still tight and Paul was coming up with one great song after another, John might have really appreciated it. You know, like, who knows?
Take over, dude. You drive for a little bit. I'll take some acid.
Take a nap in the back.
Take a nap in the back. Hang out with Mike Nesmith.
Right. Like, I could imagine that being like a really pleasant exchange at a certain point in the partnership.
Yeah. But John, I mean, so let's work into Benefit for the Mr. Kite, for the Benefit of Mr. Kite, which I believe is the poster that Mike saw in the sunroom, as far as I know, right?
Which essentially is all the lyrics derived from that.
So, John, this is something you listen to often, or?
You imagine driving around town with this blasting out of your stereo, pulling up to your house and your neighbors here.
That's the joke you made about Piggies, right? This is Piggies from the White Album. Like,
I think about it with a lot of these songs.
Yeah. So, incredible innovation, incredible creativity, incredible, you know, use of the studio, building imagery through sound. Song is kind of, eh.
I think it's a production masterpiece.
Thank you.
It's George Martin plays like four or five different types of organs in this.
I didn't know there were four or five different kinds of organs.
Yeah, and I think that I think Lennon sort of gave him carte blanche to sort of run wild with the production, and he just said like, make it sound like a circus. I want to smell the sawdust. And George really nailed it. I mean, it really has a cool carnival kind of feel to it.
Certainly a song of its time. It feels very psychedelic and trippy and must have freaked people. It's kind of scary towards the end of it, right?
Yeah, there's that sort of like organ collage.
Well, it's circus, but also music hall, you know, and like the music hall stuff. I don't relate to that tradition of the Beatles as much. What's your experience of it, Michael? Was that like mainly a piano song?
The one you're about to play or the one?
The one that we just played.
The Benefit of Mr. Kite. What do you mean a piano song? Like a Billy Joel song?
as far as how it was composed, like what do you think the genesis of it was?
I sat down there. He played it for me live in that room, and it looked to me just like him playing the piano at a party.
Right.
And I'm not sure I'm on the page you're on, John. I don't know what you mean.
Oh, so you did originally hear it like as a solo piano song then?
Yeah, I said, what are you working on? He pointed at the poster, and I said, what's this? He said, well, it's a theme we thought of. I don't know whether it's going to work or not, blah, blah. And then a couple of more tokes, and then we were sitting side by side, and said, what the hell are you doing here? This is, I'm getting high on LSD and painting my piano. He never said that out loud.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like that. And and then it was off to the races. Let's go listen to some music. What are we going to listen to? Well, I got something I brought home from the studio. And it was, what was it? It'll take me a while to remember it. But anyway, it was astounding. Just absolutely astounding. And like everybody who hears Sgt. Pepper's for the first time, having never heard anything but music from the 60s, 50s, and 40s.
Yeah. How cool is it to be able to hear something in real time and go, oh, this is as good as I was hoping it was going to be, right?
Well, that's indescribably cool. That's the holy grail. That's what we're all working for. That's why I sit around loaded all day and staring at passing trucks. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, maybe it's in there.
I had this feeling this weekend because there was a huge hype, or there's a lot of hype online about this new Fiona Apple record. And I go, all right, let me put it on. I'm going to put my headphones on. If people are saying it's, you know, it's like breathtaking, all this stuff. I put it on and I was blown away. I was like, cool, this is great. And people said it was great, and it is. And I feel it. Like, it wasn't like, usually you just kind of get disappointed by when people say stuff's great. But let's see. Should we go into George land? We have not. George has been, where's George on this record, everybody? Where's George?
Where is George? He's not doing a lot of the lead guitar. Paul's taking over a lot of the lead guitar.
And
so where is he?
I think he was in the early stage of the disease, wasn't he? I didn't see him around much. I ran into him once when we all went to dinner. He was driving a Radford Mini Cooper. I don't know whether you ever seen one of those things or not, but they're just a Mini Cooper.
Uh-huh.
But polished out like a Rolls Royce. And they're just uncanny. They're gorgeous. So I said, I got to have one of those. And he took me to the Radford plant, and I bought it on the spot, put all the stuff on it and everything. But that's what we shared, because he was a car nut.
Yeah, he was a
big... Michael, but I think in some ways, even though John was your friend, you and George have the most in common, because you also both funded comedy starting in the 70s.
You're so right. I mean, our lives, George and my life, parallels each other's in a way that none of the other guys are member of the rock royalty.
But I don't picture you guys, but maybe like when you had a conversation, like you were both introverts, and so it didn't totally spark like it did with John, but you actually, yeah, you're very parallel, you and George.
It's true. Sometimes when people are very similar, they end up not hitting it off in a way, right? As much.
Well, yeah, it was certainly never the case of anybody I ran into there. Where did I write the story about the kids chasing me around in the car, listening to the radio? George Harrison's in Corpus Christi.
Oh, in Infinite Tuesday.
That's in Infinite Tuesday.
Get Infinite Tuesday. Where is that in print? You can get it on Amazon and everything?
Oh, yeah. I call it an autobiographical riff. It's available at all bookstores. I don't think it's made it to the airports yet, but maybe.
Hudson Books. George has been absent on this record.
I think he's been in India, like literally
learning the sitar.
And in his mind, I think he's, you know, I think he's sort of going through this sort of spiritual, cultural transformation where he's sort of, you know, not as engaged in the pop songwriting and more into like learning about Indian music.
This
and
song,
the culture.
This is my favorite of the Indian George songs. I mean, from my, you know, from Love to You, this one, The Inner Light. Is there another one that I'm not thinking of? This song's fucking cool to me, and it's dark. It's got, I think it's got great lyrics. It's long. It's probably one of the longer Beatles songs. It's like almost 5 minutes. any thoughts? I think it's cool. I don't have much to say except that I think it's cool. I know that there was a challenge to have the Indian instruments and the Western strings and more traditional accompaniment work together, and that was sort of the way, figuring out how those two things were going to blend together. But I think it sounds, I think they nailed it.
Sounds great.
Not my favorite.
Well, they also, he blends the violins and cellos into this, yeah, too, right? There's like a string set.
Yeah, the strings are really cool. Okay, John doesn't want to hear any more of this. We've all...
I mean, crazy when you think about how commercially successful this album was with songs like that on it, you know?
And this is the start of side B.
A huge hit.
So you flip over... You flip over side B and you get this for 5 minutes. It's
crazy.
It
was turning people on. You know, they were really getting their minds blown by this stuff, I guess.
Well, they were. You know, when I was walking the streets and out to the occasional dinner party, I never heard anything about it. Not ever. Not the Beatles or this or that. It was the discussions of pop culture and what was getting. It had more to do with a kind of pulse, an artistic pulse that went through the whole culture, that the whole culture was just listening to. It was the beat of a different drummer.
Yeah.
It was changing. And it was a, but there wasn't any, I can't stress this enough. There was really no competitive urge on the streets to be more outrageous in dress and outlandish in ideas and so forth. That wasn't going on like it was going on in the streets of LA or the streets of San Francisco.
Right.
No, the competitive edge from rock and roll, I think, maybe came from the South, maybe came from San Francisco, maybe came from LSD, but I don't think it came from British rock and roll.
Now, I have a theory that I've now looking at the track listings has become more, has hardened now. And John, I'll be curious to see what you think of this. On Revolver, the last record, you have George's Indian-flavored Love to You, which is very...
Love You Too.
Love You Too, sorry. Love You Too, which is a bit dark, very... a lot darker, I think, than even Within You, Without You. Goes from that song into Here, There, and Everywhere from Paul. Mm-hmm. And now we go from Within You, Without You to When I'm 64. And I have this feeling that Paul was like, yeah, we'll give you the little dark, you know, Indian music. But after that, we're going to lighten things up quite a bit. You know, we're going to put a little bit of a smile on the face. You know, that's my like Paul, I mean, conniving with the track listings.
He's got that entertainer's instincts.
We've got to bring it back up, you know. So that does bring us to When I'm 64. John's favorite song. Now, you know, this is a song that Paul wrote when he was like 16, I believe.
Yeah.
Correct?
When I get older, losing my head.
It's cute. It's, I mean, there's a time in your life for this.
When I was a kid, I loved this song, and there is a video of me singing it a cappella at like a confirmation of my nephew or something, or my cousin when I was a kid. And but you know, now I don't have much of a taste for it these days.
You know what? When that Imagine video started going around like last month, you know, that when Gal Gadot put out her Imagine video and everybody was shitting on it, and they were shitting on it for good reason, but then people started going after the song Imagine. And my issue with that was, well, somebody said, like, you know, it's deep for a 10-year-old or something, you know. And I was like, but 10-year-olds need deep shit.
Yeah.
You know, like that's in, like that is resonant. Like it's going to be resonant for people at different parts of their life. And like that's what's great about the Beatles is they like work into your life, work into your life at all kinds of different periods.
And also at the time, like, you know, that was also deep for like a song that they played on the radio. Like if it was even allowed to be played on the radio.
Yeah. I mean, the idea of like these young rockers talking about growing old and what their life is going to be like when they're older, you know, that's...
Oh, I was talking about Imagine.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You're talking about when I'm 64?
Well, yeah, yes, you're totally right.
I was defending
Imagine
again. Sorry.
But, you know, musically, it's on the trajectory of Paul's kind of granny music hall style music that...
Yeah, like, this is classic granny.
Like John Levenstein said, you know, it's hard for us to relate to, but there is a tradition there.
Side two is a bummer so far, you guys.
Well, it's like they put in a song for kids on the last record with Yellow Submarine, and this is a song for like your grandparent.
It, yeah, I don't know.
Does They're this something for everyone?
Did anyone care about this song, Mike? Like that it was kind of not cool or was not whatever? Like it wasn't a rocker?
Well, I won't say that the discussion of it sucked the air out of the room, but. Get a little hard to breathe every once in a while.
Finally, a word of criticism of the Beatles.
Yeah,
so
looks like we have our first 99. Anyways, we got through it. Side two is chugging along. We've got another Paul song here with Lovely Rita. Passable. I give it a 99. Cool production.
Love that vocal at the very top.
Yeah. Another, I don't know, do you guys have a perspective? I was talking about this with Revolver, is like the influence of Ray Davies and the Kinks, being somebody that wrote songs about sort of working class wrote songs that were a little more like pedestrian. Pedestrian's not the right word, but sort of little short story kind of things. I feel like this is a continuation of that. Other than that, I don't know. They're just looking for stuff to sing about.
I feel like Paul's doing a Lennon impression on this.
Oh,
especially
totally.
That opening voice that sounds like it's Lennon, but it's Paul.
All right.
I'm realizing back in the day when I would actually play this album, I would almost always listen to side one.
You'd not flip her over.
But if I flipped her over, I wouldn't start with the first three songs.
Aha! Uh-huh. You'd get right to the good stuff at the big finale.
So, I would.
So apparently, I found the two songs they would have cut from this record if they had been able to put Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane on it. They were going to cut Lovely Rita and When I'm 64. So, John, you would have loved that decision.
Fantastic.
I mean, that
would have been a classic album.
So, if the Beatles had their way, these songs wouldn't have been on there, and you would have had Strawberry Fields and Penny.
That's amazing. That's amazing that
they
didn't
blame the label.
That's amazing to think that the Beatles didn't get to put out the Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band that they wanted to.
Yeah, I wonder if they could have really fought for it if they put their foot down, or if they were just like, you know, it'll be good for sales.
Right.
I wonder.
I mean, we should say Strawberry Fields Forever. I mean, absolutely majestic piece of songwriting and production. It's insane.
One of my favorites.
Crazy, crazy, crazy. And there's a whole video on YouTube, if you look it up, about the edit in that song where they had they had to change. There's two different versions. Two different versions of the song that were recorded at a different tempo, at a different key. They combined them. Using all kinds of wacky, you know, kind of DIY systems in their mixing room. And you can, if you watch the video, you hear it where it happens, and it's really, really remarkable, and you'll never hear it the same way again. But, and Penny Lane is a great track too. It sounds so bright and beautifully recorded. It's too bad. We have to live with Lovely Rita. Good morning. Good morning. Great horns. I don't know. Again,
Lennon said that he was inspired by a Kellogg's cornflakes commercial to write this song.
Right. Great time signature work going on here, right?
Yeah. A couple changes. This song is insane. Like, it's so crazy.
Listen to the bass. You hear what the bass is doing?
Wild. Yeah.
It's so... It's like a heavy metal bass player.
It's one of the craziest bass lines in the Beatles' history.
Boom! I love the rhyme of doing with ruin.
Yeah.
We're not really talking about the lyrics here because, like, again, it's sort of these, it's not as introspective, but it's just some clever stuff going on for sure. Wordsmithy kind of like plays on words and everything.
So that's a song about like domestic boredom a little bit, I would say, right? Or at least being in a rut.
He's got Mike Nesmith staying over. You know, it's like, can you get out of the way? I'm trying to get to the cereal here, dude.
Lennon called it a jobber. He was like, this is one
it was like, I'm gonna...
when he throws any of his songs under the bus, he's like, that was a jobber. That was just a...
He's the most unreliable narrator about his own work, right? Because all those interviews he did in the 70s where he was just throwing everything under the bus for, I don't know, amusement or boredom or just... kind of a bad, you know, he's at a place where he had not the greatest perspective on his own work, maybe, but he's really down on so much of their work at periods of times that, you know.
But I feel like that way sometimes. Like, you know, there's a lot of work that you're proud of, but also, like, I'll watch something that I worked on that all I'm thinking of is like, well, I wish I had done that. I wish we had a little extra time to shot one more take of that. Or, you know, he's probably just seeing all the little mistakes and thinking of how he could have done better.
So how long after this did he meet Yoko?
Well, probably later this year.
Same year, okay.
He would have met her, but I don't think it took them a little bit of a little while before they actually like became a couple. You want to play this bass line just to hear what's going on?
Yeah, I don't really know how to play it, but I'm going to try. It's cool. And then it goes and does it. Which is a little like Paul kind of uses that pentatonic stuff with Lady Madonna again.
Mm-hmm.
Lady Madonna. So it's the same line, basically.
It's a hack. What a hack.
Just sounds good.
It's cool.
Then we get the reprise of Sgt. Pepper's. Nothing to really remark on there. Except that great audio edit of the rooster.
Wait, alternate between the top of this song and Good Morning, Good Morning.
Okay. Yeah. A couple of birds.
Birds and birds. And then the end of Good Morning, Good Morning has a bird that also play it from the end of Good Morning, Good Morning and straight into the beginning of Pepper 2.
Well, the one thing I know about this was, as they were building these animal sounds, they were trying to, the animals were supposed to get bigger. So it was like, this animal could eat this animal and that animal could like.
Right. Oh.
Did I miss what you're trying to get to?
You're on loop, I think.
Oh, I'm on loop, yeah. Also, it seems like it might have been a subtle nod or in-joke about pet sounds, maybe. Right? Because there's so much talk about it. Pet sounds being influential in this record. It had to have been on their minds. All right. This is the big one. This is the session. Our special guest. I want to thank my special guest, Mr. Mike Nesmith, for being here for this journey. I hope it's been somewhat of an enjoyable experience for you, sir. No comment.
No, I'm commenting away. I'm just waiting for all the sonics to get in order.
This is the song. You were at the session. You were part of history here. We're going to play a little bit of it and talk about it. Is it our experience with this song, or is it something implicit that exists in those first 30 seconds or whatever? I'm looking at it, it's about 10 seconds. Does it feel really heavy right away?
Well, I don't know exactly what you're talking about.
like it just has a mood to it. Like just it's just acoustic guitar and piano, but it feels heavy.
There's air. Yeah. There's like an anticipation.
I understand what you mean. Yeah, yeah. You could say that. That's a incredible critique. Yeah.
Let the news today avoid about a lucky man. It's an incredibly sad sounding song to me.
Yeah, dark.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the first half is.
Yes. Well, I just had to laugh. Bass is doing, again, so much work here.
Very busy. I saw the photograph.
Ringo's saying, guess what? I'm in this band too, by the way. He didn't notice that the lights had changed. I just kind of want to listen to this whole song. I mean, I know it sounds like shit on your end over there, guys. I apologize. So, Mike, at the session you were at for this, had a lot of the work been done on the song already? So you were able to hear it?
Yeah, it was complete.
And what were they doing that you were there for?
I say it was complete. You know, I can't parse that out in my head.
Right.
But it sounded complete. And, you know, the only comment that John had to me was, how did the bass sound?
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Was he worried that the bass was too loud? That like Paul was cranking the bass up, and it was
no. I'll never know.
What were you gonna? What were you there at the studio to do? Were you there just to hear it? Were they playing it for everybody?
No, I got wind that they were going to go in. I was going to be there anyway, and that's when I started putting it together. But that only took, you know, 4 or 5 days, and then I was there. So. It just took a little bit of effort, but not much.
So is the orchestra part, had the orchestra had been done already, this big climax that's coming up, that was in there already?
No, that hasn't been done yet.
Okay.
I think this was the last day of the session.
John Levenstein, this is they're recording this early 1967. 65, 3 years earlier, they're playing like I Want to Hold Your Hand, which is a great song, but the jumps that this band made in 3 years, is there anything like it in pop culture that you can think of that's anything like that?
Not off the top of my head. Here's a question for you, though. I mean, as far as the song, the production value and everything, John's voice, like going back to Help and Album I Love, he started like he was filtering his voice more here, right? Like he's playing with his voice more.
Yes. I don't know on this particular song what's happening. It's
from
it's,
a performance standpoint or from like a post production or like
I don't know.
Standpoint?
I don't know which, but sometimes his voice, it seemed to me like he was singing with confidence on Help. And here, like his voice always sounds good, but I can't always, there's like other forces at work and I can't really tell. Always what's him, what's production value, what's going on exactly.
It could be that automated double tracking. That definitely will make his voice sound a little different.
Let me hear it again for just real quick.
Jets, I gotta take a step away.
All right, sir.
Thanks for joining, Michael.
Yeah, Mike, we'll let you go. We'll let you go. Are you leaving for good? We just want to say goodbye. Or are you coming back? We'll see. Maybe he's coming back.
This may have been goodbye.
No, I'm coming. I'm coming back.
Okay.
Can you see me yet?
Yeah, okay. We'll wait for you, or we'll continue.
I'll come back to button everything up.
Okay, that sounds good.
Here, I'll do a little bit of that bass while we wait.
I understand. Go ahead, Eric.
Did you guys hear?
Yeah, we're good. You're rushing, Eric. You're rushing.
Anyway, it's cool. It's cool. It's a little busy.
You know, let me just say while we don't have Michael here, I think the three of us, Eric and I talked about this, that this is to us, it feels like an overrated record generally as people that love the Beatles. It's not my favorite Beatles record. It has a lot of great songs on it. A lot of songs I would.
It's got some high highs.
It's got some high highs. This is one of them. But you know, it became a whole big deal that I don't know, and I understand why it was a big deal, but I don't know that it plays as well as some other records play now.
No, I agree, and I think part of what Michael seems to be talking about, what was going on in London at the time, was a whole experience that was bigger than the record that then people projected onto the record.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the more I think about that group, the more, you know, it never stops to kind of amaze me that not only were they so good and so talented and that it connected with so many people, but they were so sly to move forward, and they moved forward in the right ways that didn't alienate their fans. I mean, I'm sure it alienated some people, but it also brought in people. They didn't turn off.
They always kept these pop sensibilities. They had these like sort of rules that they, you know, they would break a lot of rules, but they would also follow a lot of rules, I think, that kept people engaged. Like they, you know, their songs still, a lot of them were like verse chorus, even though the, you know, they might be super experimental in other ways.
Right.
And like, you know, they still had this incredible sense of melody and harmony that even in their most experimental songs, they would still have that stuff that would keep you interested and keep you on board.
Yeah, they never rebelled. It's like the Beatles kept expanding their sound, but there wasn't a moment like Dylan going electric or the Birds going electric where it was divisive for their fans. Exactly. Like the Beatles went along for the ride.
I mean, there was probably like, if you went back, you could probably find people writing articles about like, oh, the Beatles have mustaches now. You know, how could they? It's all boys. I'm sure there was that happening. And there, I think if you look back in the contemporary pop press, there was always an angle of like the Beatles have lost their edge or they're old news. You know, there was always that happening. There was always that chatter that probably happens, you know, would have happened no matter what was going on. But they made just great choices.
Yeah.
I mean, not perfect. No one's perfect, but.
And you also can't experiment without, you know, having some failures. So like, you know, there's going to be songs where, you know, you're not going to hit it out of the park every time if you're experimenting and innovating. So there's going to be these stinkers. There's going to be clunkers.
Right.
And by the way, I don't know what was happening the day that Michael was at the Day in the Life session, but I didn't want to press.
No, I mean, there's video, there's a film of them, like it's kind of a big party.
I wonder if they were.
I thought it was when they did the orchestra, but.
I think so too. It must have been when the orchestra was there.
Yeah.
All right, I gotta say goodbye too now, you guys.
Okay, John.
Goodbye to Michael. Thank you so much for having me. You guys can take it home.
I want to thank John Levenstein A for being a guest, and I always enjoy your perspective, even though you're not as knowledgeable about the Fab Four as Eric and I. But that's not what we want. We don't want a bunch of too many cooks in the kitchen of all the boring details and trivia. I want somebody that has a point of view. And that's what you provided. But you also gave us one of the biggest guests I could ever imagine getting to talk about this band, Mike Nesmith.
Michael, thanks for coming along for the ride.
It was certainly my pleasure.
It was a real pleasure to talk to you, Mike.
Thank you. And same
thank you, Michael.
So you got a good show going there. I think podcasts are the future.
Yeah, it's fun. It's easy. You could just get a couple mics, talk for a while, and throw it up on the internet. And if you want to listen, you can. Obviously, people are listening to this right now, so we appreciate it. Thanks again. Stay safe. Take care.
Bye, Michael.
Bye-bye. Thanks, guys.
You guys can shut off. Eric, we'll wrap up.
Cool.
Thanks, John. That was awesome.
Wow, that was cool.
That was major. I mean, I'm just going to let it all roll. Who cares?
Yeah.
It's fine. It's a little long-winded in places, but that's kind of
That's the appeal.
It's the appeal.
The podcast.
We're
although,
just hanging out.
Did you see John's text?
Yeah, I know. He was worried. I think he was worried that it was rambling a little too much.
Well, but have you listened to his podcast?
John Levenstein's?
Yeah. The John Levenstein Retirement Party?
No.
It's really good. But what's so interesting about it is that it's heavily edited. It's edited as if it was like a TV show. So it's like very, very tight.
Uh-huh.
Unlike, which is like the opposite, I feel like, of most podcasts.
Right.
So I like that he's already thinking about that.
Well, I hope he's not expecting us to do much work on this. And since we are still rolling, we'll just include all this too. I'm not going to go back and lose your comments about his podcast. I think it's a positive thing that you've said about
his
podcast.
I love it. Yeah, it's John Levenstein's, I recommend it to anyone listening. It's John Levenstein's retirement party.
I think I did a live version of that. I think I'm on it in some place, in some episode. Any final thoughts on Sergeant Pepper? I know this wasn't your typical please let it be episode, but I was pretty, I don't know, I want to give myself credit for handling my interview with Mike Nesmith pretty admirably, I think.
I thought you did a great job.
And you noticed? Wait.
I enjoyed listening to
it. You know what's funny is your voice went your voice went into weird Zoom crackle territory when you said that.
Oh, really?
So it sounded like this. I think you did a good job. it sounded really
That's how I said it.
Yeah.
That's how
I mean, it was not it was no softball interview.
No. And I loved hearing the stories of someone that was not only there when the record came out, which we haven't had yet, but someone that was there when the record was made.
I know. Unbelievable. I'm going to ask Fred to do the White Album with us, I think.
Yeah. Are we splitting into two parts?
It's again, you sound drunk when it's so funny.
Should we split it into two parts?
Yeah, definitely.
Two episodes. Fred and both?
That's not what's coming next. What's coming next is Magical Mystery Tour.
Yeah.
Which is just an EP, but I mean, we all know it as an LP because it featured a fair amount of singles that they...
Are we doing Yellow Submarine at all?
We have to. Okay. And I had this vision this vision of an animation of us walking down this hallway, going past all the albums, and we see Yellow Submarine, the album, in the distance, and it's haunting us because it's the one we don't want to do.
You're gonna have to do it,
but we could have
talk
to
about Strawberry Fields.
Well, but that's on Magical Mystery Tour.
It's also on the Yellow Submarine soundtrack.
What I love about the Yellow Submarine, which is I'm excited to talk about, is It's All Too Much. That's one of my favorite Beatles songs.
Yeah, you're right.
There's Magical some fun. There's enough to talk about there. It'll
I like to talk about is Hey Bulldog.
Hey Bulldog is a
lot
of
my
fun
favorite
too.
Underrated. I think underrated track.
It's a rucka. All right, but we'll get to that when we get to it. So thanks again. Thanks to Mike Nesmith and John Levenstein, and thank you, Eric. We'll talk soon. Peace and love.
Thank you. Peace and love.
I never could be any other.